Who do you think you are to speak to me like that? I'm sure you find yourself thinking that from time to time. Someone asks you to do something, offers you some advice. It's not entirely welcome. And then you start to think, who is this person who's talking to me? Why should I do what they say? Do they even know me well enough to give me this advice or to boss me around? Who do you think you are? Sometimes we can feel like that as we read the Bible. Bits of it aren't particularly welcome. Most of us don't like to have our beliefs challenged. Even more, we don't like to have our behavior challenged. And we find ourselves thinking, Bible, who do you think you are to talk to me like that? Or maybe you never read the Bible. Maybe it would never even occur to you to open a Bible because you think, that book on my shelf, why on earth would I want to read that? What is that book that I should take my time to read it? What does it think it is that it demands that I do any more with it than leave it shut? The book of Revelation can make us feel like that as well. It was a letter written by the Apostle John. John didn't make up what he wrote. 2 weeks ago we learned that Jesus sent his angel to John to show him some visions and to dictate some messages. And we get that again in verse 10 of today's reading. On the Lord's Day, that means Sunday, I was in the Spirit, I was praying, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet, which said, write on a scroll what you see, and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. The number seven represents totality. This letter was intended for every church to read in every age. And the seven listed here were the biggest post offices on the route the letter would have travelled. On the back of the service sheet, I put a little map so you can see where they all are if you didn't know. And if you look, the order they're listed in here is just simply a clockwise direction of travel from the coast round. So literally, the postman, the messenger, would have carried this letter to those big population centres in turn, and from there, the churches in smaller towns would have been able to get to it as well. Well, like us, John is curious. Who is this speaking to me? And the seven churches would have been curious as well. Who is this who is talking to us? And then John's curiosity gets the better of him. Verse 12, I turned round to see the voice that was speaking to me. And this is what he sees. He doesn't see a person at all. He sees seven golden lampstands. That's funny. I'm sure the lampstands weren't talking to me, he thinks. And then he sees a person walking among the lampstands. And what he sees is so brilliant and so frightening that he collapses on the ground as though dead. But this individual that he sees gently puts his right hand on him, speaks to him, and puts him back on his feet before repeating the instruction. Verse 19, write therefore what you have seen, what is now, and what will take place later. So who does this person think he is to speak to us like this? Maybe you ask that as you hear any part of the Bible being read. Well, John got to see the answer. And by recording his vision, we can know the answer too. Three headings for us. First, he is the glorious Jesus who terrifies. The glorious Jesus who terrifies. Let me read again the description of the man among the lampstands. He was dressed like a high priest from the Old Testament. Among the lampstands was someone like a son of man, dressed in a robe reaching down to his feet with a golden sash round his chest. And then here's what he looked like. And no surprise, if you know the book of Revelation, we get given exactly seven details. The hair on his head was white like wool, as white as snow. His eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace. His voice was like the sound of rushing waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and coming out of his mouth was a sharp double-edged sword. His face was like the sun, shining in all its brilliance. At one level, what John saw was highly symbolic. This is not what Jesus actually looks like. It's just what he looks like in this vision. When we meet the risen Jesus in the Gospels, he eats fish. He still looks fully human. These details are there to tell us something about Jesus. It's rich symbolism. I'm not going to go into each detail now because we will meet these details again in chapters 2 and 3, one at a time. So we'll get to look at them then. What we get, though, here is a wonderful tapestry of lots of characters from the Old Testament. Take the Son of Man in Daniel 7, the Ancient of Days in the same chapter, add Ezekiel 1 and Isaiah 6, where those two prophets had visions as God called them, and then mix in the angel that spoke to Daniel in chapter 10, mix all those characters together, woven together, you get this one glorious figure. I don't know if you saw the drama that the BBC put out earlier this year called Dickensian. I don't doubt that the hardcore Dickens fans hated it. In which case, you should know that Tony Jordan, who wrote it, is himself a massive Dickens fan, so he meant no disrespect. Take lots of well-known Dickens characters, and then write a storyline with them all in together, each in the character that Dickens gave them. So if you'd ever wondered what would happen if the Cratchits met the Bumbles, met the Havishams, you get to find out. Kind of fan fiction. Well, the vision here is a bit like that. Here is a beautiful and imaginative tapestry of lots of characters from the Old Testament, all woven together. John does that a lot in Revelation. He pulls together allusions to lots of different Old Testament passages and brings them together to get his own message across. It's symbolic. This is not what Jesus actually looks like. And yet, I don't want to overstate that. You'll remember the account of the Transfiguration. It's recorded in three of the four Gospels. Peter has just twigged that Jesus is the promised Messiah. Jesus then explains that he has to suffer and die. Does that mean he's any less the Lord and God that Peter has just figured out? To answer that, Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up a high mountain. There he's transfigured before them. His clothes and his face become dazzling white. God draws back the curtain and gives them a little glimpse of Jesus in all his glory, in all his splendor. And that's what's happening here. So this is John's second time to look at this. These details might be symbolic, but they're not made up, and they won't mislead us. Jesus is alive today, and he really is this glorious. This vision is 100% accurate. In some ways, if you saw Jesus alive today, he would look just like this, if not more glorious than this. So just feel with me for a moment what it must have been like to be John seeing this character. His hair as white as wool or as white as snow. If you go skiing, you need goggles because the snow is too bright to look at. So white. Take a brand new white shirt and out of the packet, never worn, and hold it up against fresh snow and the shirt looks filthy. Have you ever stood close to a great waterfall, Niagara, Victoria, take your pick, and try to have a conversation with that roar in the background? His voice like the sound of rushing waters, the sheer power of that sound. Take a piece of metal, put it in a furnace to soften it and shape it, leave it there until it's glowing red hot. Bring it out, look at it, touch it. No, don't touch it. Feet like that. We all know you should never look directly at the sun, only with really, really blackened glasses. And so we could go on. Absolutely awesome. No wonder John just fell down at his feet as though dead. It is terrifying. It almost kills him. Next time you are listening to the Bible and you're tempted to ask, who is this who is speaking to me like that? Remember this vision. This is who is speaking to you. We domesticate Jesus in our thinking today. We imagine him to be much smaller, more tame, more ordinary than he really is. If Jesus walked in here in person, in body, one Sunday morning to join in with our service, we would be absolutely terrified. And we would probably do what John did and just collapse. One day you will get to meet him. When he returns, he will come back in his glory with all his holy angels. And if you are a Christian, I hope that you are looking forward to that day like you have never looked forward to anything in your life. But I hope there's also a little bit of you that is absolutely terrified at the thought of meeting him. Otherwise, it's not the real Jesus that you're contemplating meeting. That's the first heading. Who is this? He's the glorious Jesus who terrifies. Second, he's the risen Jesus who lives forever. The risen Jesus who lives forever. Jesus doesn't leave John on the floor. Verse 17 is wonderfully tender. Then he placed his right hand on me and said, "Do not be afraid." It doesn't say that Jesus set him back on his feet, but the implication is that he had no need to be afraid. There are a few times when Old Testament prophets had visions that wiped them out, and they are always put back on their feet. Jesus gently picks John up. Don't be afraid. Why not? Firstly, he's the first and the last, but then look at verse 18. I am the living one. I was dead, and now look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. And so John need not fear. Let's just draw out the logic here. There are three steps to this. Firstly, Jesus died and is alive. He's alive forever and ever. He will never die again. Second, that means he holds the keys of death and Hades. Hades is where the Old Testament said you went immediately after you died. Jesus has defeated death, so he's now in charge of death. He's conquered. Third, death no longer needs to frighten us because Jesus rules. Jesus rules over death. He's in charge there just as much as anywhere else. Imagine a Western politician wants to visit part of Iraq that's been occupied by the group calling itself Islamic State. They would never be allowed to go there while Islamic State was still around. Far too risky. They could be kidnapped, killed, anything could happen. But they could just about go to an area that's been cleared. The Iraqi forces are fully in charge. They've driven out all the insurgents. They are in control there now, not just in theory, but in practice. This is now a safe place that people can visit without fear. That's what Jesus has done to death. He's now in charge, so death poses no fear for us at all. Jesus lives. Jesus holds the keys to death, so death need not frighten us. And there's one last step, then we'll see why John does not need to be frightened of Jesus. Why is death frightening for us? Is it not this? We know that we are all guilty before God. God is perfectly good and holy, and we are not. That's why John collapsed before the risen Jesus. He hadn't got a leg to stand on because the perfectly radiant, holy, awesome God had turned up full brightness. Which means what we deserve is for God to lock us up in the prison called death and to throw away the key. We'd be locked up there forever. We could be trapped in death forever. But Jesus is risen. He's conquered death. So the fear of death is gone, which means it's no longer a death sentence for us to see God in all his beautiful perfection. And so, don't be afraid, John. I'm the living one. I hold the keys of death and Hades. Who is this speaking to us? It's Jesus, the living one. Why would we listen to him? Not only because he's so glorious that we would melt if he came into the room, but also because he's so gracious and so powerful that he's the one who draws our hearts to him, who has earned our loyalty and devotion, who has taken away the fear of death. The risen Jesus, who lives forever. Why listen to Jesus? He's the glorious Jesus who terrifies. He's the risen Jesus who lives forever. Third, he's the nearby Jesus who knows us. The nearby Jesus who knows us. He appears among seven golden lampstands. He holds in his right hand seven golden stars. And you're wondering what these represent. No need to wonder. The answer's right here, verse 20. The mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand under the seven golden lampstands is this. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. The lampstands represent the churches. The stars represent the angels of the churches. Now, the word angel also means a messenger. So some people think that the angels of the churches are their leaders, their human leaders, who are to pass on the message of this letter to their congregation. That's possible. But the rest of Revelation uses angel in the same way that we think of an angel, heavenly beings. Elsewhere in the Bible, we meet the idea that individuals have an angel whose job is to look out for them. We also meet the idea elsewhere that nations have their own guardian angel who represents that nation in the heavenly court. So it's not too hard to believe that churches do too. That means that of all the billions and billions of angels, one of them is the angel of St. Mary's Kemsing, and one of them is the angel of St. Mary's Woodlands. And God symbolically addresses the seven churches by addressing their angels. But here's the important thing. Jesus is pictured among the lampstands. Indeed, John sees the lampstands first and only then sees Jesus walking among them. Lampstands. Christian churches are lights. The world is often a dark place. It rejects God and his rule. Churches are meant to shine God's light into the darkness. And as we represent God in the world, Jesus is here with us. He's not distant, far off, clueless what goes on. He's right here. You know the saying, when the cat's away, the mice can play. The attempted coup in Turkey began when the president was out of the country and ended when he returned to the country. There was 30 minutes the week before last when we had no prime minister. The old one had resigned and the new one was not yet in post. One friend of mine remembered what it used to be like to be at school. And he tweeted, "Yay, there's no prime minister for the next half hour. Let's all muck about." When it comes to Christian churches, the cat is not away, so the mice cannot play. There can be no coup. There might be a great deal of fun and laughter in the life of our church, because we are a family after all, but there's no mucking about in the sense of pretending nobody's watching us, gone to the staff room for a coffee for 20 minutes. I said earlier that if Jesus were to walk into this church one Sunday, we would be absolutely terrified if he came in his full glory. But I was very careful to qualify that. I said if he walked in here in person, in body. Because actually he is here every week. He's never far away. He knows everything that goes on. So who is this speaking to me? Why should I listen? This is the nearby Jesus who knows us. And as we hear his word being read, as we plan how we will respond, as we have that thought that wonders who's addressing us, he's right here to witness that whole process going on inside your head and as you chat over coffee. Who does he think he is to talk to me like that? If it's the book of Revelation or the Bible we're talking about, Jesus is the one speaking to us. The glorified Jesus who terrifies. The risen Jesus who lives forever. And the nearby Jesus who knows us. So we'd better pay attention.